Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is Dumpty Dum, sponsored by managers.
Hello and welcome. It's one of those very special Dumpty Dums where we dispense with Jacqueline and talk of Saint-Gwen in France and even the Quarterinerus. And basically we get to the hub of the matter. We speak to somebody who's one of the, what I call one of the unseen gods of Ambridge. And we have with us one of those unseen gods. Now, this is Graham Hervey, who was the agricultural story editor for The Archers for some 34 years. He was also the author of books including The Killing of the Countryside and Carbon Fields. And I believe, sir, you have a new book out. What is this new book, Graham?
Well, it's not actually out yet. It's a crowdfunded book and we're about halfway to our target. And it's called
Good Heavens.
The Archers.
Good Heavens. Now, a crowdfunded book. This sounds very 2022. What exactly is a crowdfunded book?
Well, it's a publishing company called Unbound, and you send them the book and they do a nice page with a design, a nice cover. Then you invite everyone to pledge to cover the launch costs. And when and if you make that target launch total, out comes the book.
So, wow. Well, so would I be right in speculating that part of your marketing campaign was to get onto a podcast about the Archers where fans of the Archers who might want to buy that book for Christmas could well be present?
Yeah, that was part of my campaign, but I'm afraid the book won't be out before Christmas. But I'd certainly not support the book.
Well, I was on about Christmas 2023.
Oh, that's the one. That's the key one.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So there is a book, and tell us about the book. What exactly does the book entail?
Well, I worked on the Archers. I started on the Archers in It was 1984. And I started as a script writer. And really for the next, a major part of my adult life was spent part of the time in this village. And these characters I was writing stories for and writing dialogue for, I got to know really well. And I got to know them as well as friends in my life, I suppose, in many cases. So I wanted to write about that. When I left the Archers, I wanted to write about that, but I wanted to combine my story and what had happened to me in the countryside particularly, because I'm sort of passionately interested in farming and got my own views on it. And I also want to link it with the characters I knew on the Archers. So, for example, Joe and Eddie Grundy, I'd maybe write about an idea I'd had for the real countryside and see how they deal with it. So in a way, through sort of 30-odd years of my life, reality, my own reality and Ambridge reality were sort of intertwined. So I tried it out. I put it all in the book and I sent it to these publishers. And we also sent it to Stephen Fry, who liked it a lot. And he actually was kind enough to say that the prism of this village of Ambridge was a great prism for looking at the wider society and life in Britain generally, which is what I'd hoped to do.
You know, I've always thought that about the Archers, that if you want to understand the British class system, you know, listen to the Archers. Listen to the Archers. You're gonna get a lot of it there. But Graham, can I let you into a little bit of a secret? You might terminate this call straight away, but here's a secret. On this podcast, I've been known to say the following. I don't know why there's all this farming chat in the Archers. It gets in the way of the drama. Now, please tell me, right, that my views are not only wrong, but heretical. And tell us how exactly you, for 34 years, melded stories about the countryside, about farming, about agriculture into the docudrama.
Well, I guess it's a long story. It's partly why I don't have any kind of farming background. I grew up in a council house in Reading.
But oh, wow.
For whatever reason, I decided I wanted to learn about farming. So I worked at some farms, went to university and studied agriculture. And when I eventually wound up as a freelance farming journalist, and I was sort of writing for Farmers Weekly and Farming News, those kind of papers. And as a student, I'd started listening to the Archers. And, you know, my sort of co-agricultural students, we all thought the Archers was kind of our program. We kind of felt a sort of ownership of it. And all the other students and doing electronics and stuff like that, they thought we were really weird. We listened to this show quarter to seven every evening. But we loved it. And, you know, when I was out in the real world of farming, I continued listening to the Archers. And I remember thinking one day, well, you know, that's probably the most useful thing I ever learned at university was the Archers. And I'd have a go at writing for it. And the Archers was getting a lot of criticism. I mean, a lot of people, I guess, share your view about agriculture, that it gets in the way of real drama. But a whole lot of people that were at that time anyway, and we're talking about the sort of mid-80s, they thought there wasn't enough farming in it. And it sort of, this drama, which had been set out to explain the English countryside and English village life in the 1950s, that had now been forgotten, and it was all sort of soap stories. And I knew they were getting flack for this in the media, so I thought, well, if I make up some scenes and some stories with a lot of farming in it, that'll get me a job on the show. Well, it wasn't quite that simple, but eventually I did get a job on the show. And although I remember the first lot of trial episodes I wrote for the editor, he said, these are pretty dire, Graham. But he said, I'll keep you on because nobody else is doing much agriculture. So I thought, I got a trial week's episode. And I thought, well, if I fill it with a lot of farming, they may not notice that, you know, some of the human drama isn't so great. But it's interesting that, I don't know, it's luck or judgment. I did my second lot of trial episodes. And when I sent them in, the editor, who was a guy called William Smethurst back in the 80s, and he said to me, well, if anything, Graham, these are worse than your first lot. But he said out of the 25 or 30 scenes, there was one scene I really liked, and it was introducing a new character. This is showing my age. It's a new character called Elizabeth Archer, and she was a 17-year-old at that time. And the first time she was appearing as a teenager, I had to have a sort of flirtatious scene with her and Nigel Pargeter in the orchard at Brookfield. And it was that scene he liked so much that he kept me the job, really. So for the next 10 years, I managed to hang on to it and put a lot of farming in my my scenes. And that seemed to keep me there.
Yeah, no, so that for me is fascinating, because what I presumed, and very obviously I was wrong and you've corrected me, was that as the agricultural editor, what you would be doing would be to say, we need to talk about this issue, silage or polytunnels or whatever, right? Some level of blight which is happening with some kind of crop. And then you would say, this is what we need to talk about. And then you might map out how this issue could be dealt with by whatever farm. And then the other writers would write the dialogue. I had no idea because, you know, I did know of you, Graham. It's kind of my job to know of you. But I had no idea that you were actually fundamentally writing dialogue and scripts. That I did not know.
Well, I did that for 10 years because they had an agricultural editor when I joined as a scriptwriter, and his name was Anthony Parkin. I knew him quite well through my sort of farming journalist days. So for the first 10 years on the show, I was just a scriptwriter. But I did put a lot of farming in my scripts. But then when Tony Parkin retired, I asked the boss if I could have his job. And so I continued scriptwriting, but I was mostly writing storylines, and it wasn't quite as you imagined. It's true I would read my Farmers Weekly and look for the big farming issues that were going on, but because I'd been a writer and I knew these characters so well, I could actually turn it into a storyline, really, that would unfold as a drama over the week. So I think that's how I seem to make it work, simply because I knew what the writers wanted, and most of them didn't know that much about farming. But I knew what they'd want. So I could bring the emotion into my storyline notes and the dramas and the conflicts, the human conflict I can actually put into these farming issues, if you like. So it was a mixture of script writing and the kind of things you know, the technical knowledge about farming and what was going on at that time of year.
So are you up to the, I take it that, you know, once an agriculture editor on the Archer is always an agricultural editor on the Archer. So you're all up to all up with the current script line, plot lines. So you all know, so you know about the pants in the soil, the underpants in the soil.
I do, yes. It's got to be cotton pants.
So no hint of polyester in them at all then?
Polyester won't work because microbes don't recognise plastics.
So here's the thing, right? When you see that storyline now, do you say, God damn it, that's a great one. I could have shoehorned that in, right? Or do you say, you know what you're doing there, etc. How do you feel about the agricultural direction of storyline since you've gone? Permission to speak freely.
I mean, I like that story. I think that's a great story, but it's a great kind of, it's a few great scenes at the moment. I don't know what kind of story it's going to turn into. Mm. I think generally the farming's been very good since I left, but I'm very hesitant to say anything else, but I don't know it. Yeah.
I just gave you permission to speak freely, Graham. No one listens to the podcast. No, you could have said, you know.
I realise that. I'm also aware that they've had a couple of, you know, I think they've had two or three agricultural editors since I left. So, and I mean, the present one, Sybil Roscoe, and she hasn't been in post very long, so I'm very reluctant to talk about current stories, so I think it's fair on her.
Oh, listen, absolutely. Listen, I'm just pulling your leg and teasing you. What I thought was lovely, and you have mentioned the Grundys, was that how they've managed to take that story and bring it all the way back to the rivalry between Joe and Bert. I just thought it was genius.
That,
you know,
yes, that was great.
Yeah, these two old duffers that for years were frenemies and whatever, and even in death.
Yes, you know? that was fantastic. I agree.
Yeah, really, yeah, absolutely.
And it is. I mean, you realize when you work on the show, you know, how fortunate you are to work on something that's gone on so long, because it has that backstory, it has that sort of family history to it. So you can do stories like that. It's just wonderful, I think.
So, you know, over 34 years, you very obviously had a couple of, you know, three or four corking storylines. You know, when you know you're tucking yourself in bed at night and you think back at Time of the Archers, you know, what are the three stories you go, you know what, I knocked the ball out of the park there? That's, you know, I'm proud of those.
Well, I guess the first one I did as agricultural editor was about GM crops, and it was quite controversial. This was 20-odd years ago, I should think, but it was about...
Is that when Kirsty's going to come into it?
No, I think it was before Kirsty. It was Tom Archer, an environmental activist. And he went out and trashed his Uncle Brian's experimental GM crop. And he got charged with criminal damage. And I remember the editor at the time said to me, well, look, we do this story, Graham, but it's such a controversial subject that you've got to be spot on with your facts on this. and we've got to be even-handed because, and it's, I put a huge amount of work actually, but it paid off in the end. We were very fortunate that two women had been charged with criminal damage of a GM crop, and they were due to come to Crown Court in Somerset, no, in Plymouth, in Devon. This was just before we ran the story, just before I wrote the story. And then kind of a week before the trial opened, the prosecution withdrew their case, and the case was dropped. The speculation in the press was that the government had intervened because they didn't want the pros and cons of GM discussed in court. I don't know if that's the case. But anyway, I phoned up the prosecutor, the Crown prosecution guy down in Plymouth, and said, look, now you're not doing this case, can you talk to me about an Archer story? And he was very happy to talk about that case. And I also, very expensive London law firm was doing these two women's defence, and I phoned them up, and the guy there said, well, look, my wife's a great Archers fan, so if you come and see me on a Sunday, I'll talk to you for free about our defence case. So I did all that, and then I wrote the episodes for the week, and we ran the trial right through the week, which was Monday to Friday in those days. I had to assure the boss and prove to her that we almost to the second, the pro-GM case was matched by the anti-GM case. And then at the end of the week, when Tom could either be found guilty, I mean, we then had to pass it higher up in the BBC as to whether he should be. And they eventually came down and said, well, he can be not guilty. And it was. What was particular, and so it was a great story for us, and it was mentioned in the House of Commons. Some MP said he'd learned more about GM from the Archer story. So, and then about, I don't know, 3 months later, it happened that a real live case came up. The head of Greenpeace, who was a guy called Peter Melchett, also was charged with criminal damage for trashing a GM crop, and he was using the same defence. In fact, the defence firm that had advised me were engaged. The guy phoned me up and said, I can't help you anymore. I didn't need him to be honest. But he said, we're doing this real case for Greenpeace. And that was heard in court, the same defence case, same prosecution, and Peter Melchett was found not guilty too. So we were about, and the Archers, we were ahead of real life. That 6 months, that was a good story. It's kind of quite a scary story because, I knew if I'd got anything wrong, it would have been.
Just we'll come to another one, right?
Okay.
Be honest, right? Where did you want Tom to end up? Did you want him to be not guilty, or did you want, for the sake of drama, let's throw him behind bars like Susan Carter a few years beforehand?
I want him to be not guilty because I was was personally fairly against GM in agriculture, so that's why I asked to get the story done, and the boss Vanessa was rightly very careful about how it was done. Mm. So it was done in a very balanced way. But I did want to get off. Yeah,
I think it's really interesting that you talked about this issue and how controversial it was back then. I think it's less so now. We live in much more environmentally conscious times than, let's say, 20 years ago. And just on that, I know when the Bridge Farm lot in the 80s they were always the pioneers for new farming techniques, which were much more organic, weren't they? The Bridge Farm lot.
Yeah.
And they were seen as outliers in that regard, and it's really interesting how now none of it's within question at all. But how often did you have to go up the food chain, so to speak, and have the greater and the better in the BBC basically say, yes, we can do this, and no, we can't. Because I think that's really interesting in terms of, because it's a public service broadcaster, they're always trying to be careful. If you're writing, let's say, for ITV, I'm presuming you wouldn't have had that level of control. So how often did you have to have things, given the green light?
It's very rare. I mean, it happened on other stories, but my farming stories, I think that's the only time I can remember an outcome having to be referred higher up for, the final turn, twist of the story. I found it interesting there that you said Bridge Farm was kind of like the centre of development of the new organic techniques. You see, to me, my age and vintage, organic is the real farming because, you went back, to time, my childhood, everything was organic then. And so we're sort of 50 years into this great experiment. I mean, all food was organic from the start of farming about 10,000 years ago until 50 years ago. And now a lot of people, me included, think it was a wrong direction to go in.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And so it's really interesting. I've written about this. The Archers came out of this world of small mixed farms. At the end of World War II, two-thirds of farms in Britain were under 100 acres. It was a land of small farms. And the Archers was about small farmers. What's happened to Britain and also what's happened in Ambridge is that farming from being mostly about people like the Grundys, who would have been very ordinary, basic farmers in lots of Britain at that time, have now almost been marginalised. And farmers are now very middle class and, got big acreages and that. And in a way, the Archers promoted this, although it was a program that was supposed to be about, that started featuring small farmers. It was actually undermining that whole structure because it was actually reflecting the government messages about farms had to get bigger and mechanized and use more chemicals and basically get people off the land. That's what happened. And now, in many ways, it's a big mistake.
That's fascinating. And me being somebody who's not grown up in the countryside, and I must admit my only link to the countryside is the Archers. I remember just last year I went to the countryside, visited a friend, and I was up close and personal with a cow. I realized that bloody big size those beasts are. You know, that, you know, I knew it was a cow. I didn't realize the size of this thing.
Yeah.
Right, whatever. So, like, I literally, my only consequential link to the countryside is the archers. So I wasn't aware of the business of agriculture and how that has changed. And I suppose if I'm forced now to think about it, somebody like Brian and, you know, and BL with all their various holdings, you know, they seem like almost like the evil corporate end of farming, you know, and that's, and I'm trying to work out, is that my perception because of my political leanings, or am I taking it in through osmosis through the storylines? Brian Aldridge, wonderful character. But when he talks about farming, he doesn't talk about it with the same passion that, let's say, David or Tony or Pat. You know, it is very different. It's a business, whereas with them, it's a vocation. And they're very much our stewards, aren't they, of the land?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I suspect my politics are similar to yours, actually, Royfield, because I always thought of Brian as the big business farmer and did not have that emotional attachment to the land that the Archers had, or I must say the Grundys had, because my favourite characters the whole time I was there was the Grundy family, and for much of the time I was there it was Joe and Eddie and Clary, that threesome at Grange Farm. And to me, they almost represented the real Archers. They certainly represented the British countryside when the Archers started. They were small tenant farmers. They were kind of, they're kind of direct inheritors of peasant farming, really, which Britain was, and well, the world was, if you go back a couple of hundred years, and slowly big business farming sort of made it corporate, and the Aldridges represented that, and the estate, of course, and the Archers were somewhere in the middle, because, you know, when it started, Dan Archer had a small farm. But Phil Archer was the one who kind of mirrored what was happening in the wider countryside, because he got bigger and he got very middle class. But the whole time I was there, it was almost a sort of a rule that we had to keep Brookfield and David and Ruth and the family, they had to be sort of middle of the road. They had, you know, had to care for their animals, had to care for the land, and we could maybe do more ruthless things with the Aldridges. But alongside that, my personal fight was to stop the Grundys becoming totally comic characters, because I think they represented sort of working tenant farmers who didn't have an investment in land because they were, you know, just renting and so on. And they were introduced as comic characters, and I fought against making them totally that. I've got great hopes for George Grundy, because I know he's having trouble with his literacy at the moment at college, but I think he'll be great.
I think that's fascinating, because, you know, it's pulling us back to something which we said really at the start of our conversation, is that if you want to understand the British class system, go listen to the Archers.
Yeah.
Right. And so to pull up the Grundys is just really a massive case in point. And the Grundys have been perennial bad luck characters. And if you follow the Archers on Twitter, and I don't really anymore, but Twitter, if we're just being honest about it, skews politically left of center. And all of the Archers fans on there have always been, for years, have been bemoaning the fact that the Grundys are a working class bad luck trope. So it's really interesting the fact that, you know, you have been, when you had your time on the show, that you were very much aware of that and trying to break out of that stereotype. And and one of the denouements in their whole kind of plot line was when they had to move to, was it Meadow Rise? They had to move to the council.
Meadow Rise, yes.
Yeah. And they lost they lost the farm completely. But it was always that, you know, they were cutting corners, they couldn't properly invest in the farm, and they did things very much kind of fly by night, and then they lost it. So that's utterly fascinating. And just what it's worth, I think our politics do align as well, Graham. But so that's, give us another storyline which, you know, you definitely hang your hat on.
Just to finish that Grundy thing, I mean, I remember there's a time when Ed Grundy, I agree with all you say about, you know, the Grundys have sort of made this comic trope, really. But there was a time when Ed Grundy, I mean, he had his problems as a young lad, and he'd come through them, really, and he'd been helped by Oliver, he'd started his own dairy and that sort of thing. There was a time when, he lost those cows. But he managed to, and this is one of my stories, he managed to buy himself a tractor. And I know so many sort of country, mostly boys, but some girls now, who, once they've got a tractor, they can set themselves up as independent contractors. And I had Ed Grundy do this. And there was a moment I went to the boss and said, look, you know, I know Ed Grundy's in the real world who've done this. They've got their first tractor and they've become independent. You know, they've got their own independent businesses, their own businesses for the first time, and do very well. And she said to me, yeah, but Ed's a Grundy, we can't have him doing very well. And so I actually realized that, you know, on that show, the Grundy family are there to serve that stereotype. And I was unhappy about that. Moving on, I chose one of my final stories. I remember when I took over, well, before I was agricultural editor, I remember the then agricultural editor, Anthony Parkin, at one of the script meetings said, we were talking about the families and how they, the farming families, and how they were in terms of their business security. And he said, you know, of all the farming characters, Brian Aldridge, the Aldridges are, you know, bulletproof, really. They, you know, they've got so much, and their land is worth so much that, you know, they've got, that it would take a huge, you know, the whole economy, farming economy, would have to collapse for the Aldridges to, you know, suffer. So I always kind of remembered that for 20 years and thought, well, one day I'll see if I can find a way to bring down the Aldridges. So I had this idea. Well, it's an idea I had in connection with another drama that I was involved in at the time. And I remembered back in the 1970s, around the time we went into the EU and all the environmental restrictions on dumping dangerous industrial chemicals tightened up. There were lots of stories in the farming press I used to write for about how farmers would take backhanders and allow some local industrials to dump toxic metals on their land. So I remember, and there was a big story in the Sunday Times in the 70s on this. It was, you know, and I thought, well, what if Brian Aldridge, we none of us knew, not even Jennifer, that he'd taken, you know, when he was maybe struggling a bit, when he'd first taken this farm, maybe he was a bit overstretched for cash, and taken some money to bury this cache of drums of toxic chemical. And a few years ago, you'll remember, River, we had that flood. And I thought, well, what if that flood had actually displaced the soil and some of these drums had started leaking? And what if they started leaking into the River Am and all the fish died and it was traced back to Brian Aldridge? So I found a way, actually, to bring down the Aldridge. They got moved out of this wonderful farmhouse and poor Jennifer lost her wonderful kitchen.
She did. She lost her kitchen.
Was it one of the cottages? I can't remember.
You sir, are a revolutionary. You know, you. That's like how to bring down the rich and the powerful. Well done.
So I guess that worked pretty well. And it certainly changed the dynamics of the farming there. I guess it was the end of Brian's generation, really, wasn't it? And you know, the new generation farming that land. So it's good. Yeah, good innings.
Absolutely. On that, I've met Charles Collingwood just the once in a hotel. I walked into a lift, and I just, for a moment, I lost myself. I should have pressed ground floor, and he was behind me. He said, "Ground floor, please," like this. And I went, "Bloody hell, you're Brian Aldridge." And he went, "Yes, I am." I was like, just to hear that voice, you know, yeah, but anyway.
So you didn't know his face, so it was just the voice.
Absolutely, yeah. Did not. Absolutely. Fantastic. Did not. It was, you know, and even if I had half recognized the voice, it was the last thing I was expecting when I just walked into a lift, you know. Oh. And then I turn around, and I just for a moment I've forgotten to press the button. He's a ground floor, please. Bloody hell. But he seemed to be doing all right. It was quite a swish hotel, so I don't know if you could have brought him down a little bit lower, Graham.
Yes, he's still a fair amount of money, yeah.
So why did you decide after 34 years that your time was up in Ambridge?
A mixture of reasons. It was a great wrench to leave because it had been so much of my life. And although it was always, I mean, throughout that time, I was always on a freelance contract, an annual freelance contract. It was extraordinary, really. So about this time of year, I'd always wonder if I'd get one for next year. But I kind of adjusted to that. But I was doing, you know, still doing journalism, and I started writing some books on agriculture. I think if one of my books had done better, I probably would have left a bit earlier because it does, you know, even working as a part time on the Arches, it actually engages a huge amount of your conscious waking time, really, because you're almost whatever you do, you're thinking about the next lot of storylines. I mean, it was a bit of a treadmill, to be absolutely honest. I had, you know, so every month I had to turn in maybe 7 or 8 work through storylines, you know, from inventing them to researching them to delivering them the storylines that I worked through over a series of weeks and so on. So it was always there.
Over your time there, did that churn get worse, that you felt more on a treadmill?
In a strange way, it got easier because I became more confident. You have a sense of a treadmill when you have this looming deadline and you're not sure whether you're going to deliver anything. But I've been, you know, after 20 years of doing that, I got confident that I would think of stories. I could look through Farmers Weekly and on a Friday and pick out 3 or 4 stories. So maybe the other thing, I always wanted to write more books. And if any of my books had sold better, none of them sold particularly well. And, you know, people would come to me, "Fantastic book you read, that's going to change everything." And sort of 10 people would buy it. And so I kind of like to have been engaged in changing farming more, really. So I sometimes think maybe I stayed in Ambridge a bit too long. But, it became like a family, and it's just hard to say goodbye to it. That sounds very odd, I know. But you did feel you knew these characters, and when you left, it's like you're not going to see them again. I mean, you do, because I still listen to the Archers, obviously. Is that an answer?
I'll accept that as an answer. How do you think, in terms of the agricultural storylines, Brexit was portrayed in Ambridge? I must admit, I very obviously, as I said before, I'm not a creature of the countryside, but the one thing that's really grated with me was, I think there should have been more conversation, because one of the key things that the EU did was subsidies towards farmers. And then I was always surprised by Adam, somebody who not only was he a farmer, but also very well travelled, that he was a Brexiteer. But that could well just be my prejudice as being a Remainer. So that must have been an issue which you had to sit down and really think about with other scriptwriters, you know, Brexit and how it would, and how the various different characters would respond to that result.
The thing is, at the BBC, we had to make sure that the whole Brexit issue was, you know, balanced in the same way as all the other stories. I didn't have a great issue with Adam being pro-Brexit, simply because his backstory was, you know, before he came back to Ambridge, he'd worked in development in different parts of the world. And I know people I knew in development were very against, the subsidies, particularly the ones that came under the Common Agricultural Policy, because, I mean, basically all they did was create surpluses that get dumped on world markets, basically sold off cheap onto world markets, and they depressed prices for farmers in poorer countries. So I think I could...
Just on that point...
Taking that view.
On that point, Graham, because it's something which I've become aware of in other industries. There's a quick detour. One of the most fascinating podcasts, because this is a podcast I ever listened to, was an NPR one, Planet Money, which gave you the history of recycled clothes, of secondhand clothes. And actually, a lot of the clothes which we take to the secondhand shop don't stay in Britain. They end up in developing economies. And so if you always look at a bit of film about, let's say, Kenya or somewhere in Burkina Faso, invariably the kids are always wearing Premiership football shirts. They always are, right? And it does exactly what you've just said. It means that those indigenous industries around clothing don't have a hope of really starting, because our secondhand clothes are getting dumped into third world markets, and we feel like we're doing a good thing, but it really is at a detriment to indigenous industries. Do you think, though, that Adam's position when it comes to Brexit was completely and utterly explained in that regard? Because what you've said to me makes sense, but I don't remember, and maybe I missed it, but I remember him arguing for that at the time.
I would agree. I can't remember the details. I know we had lots of discussion, obviously, about it. But I don't remember. I kind of agree with you that there wasn't enough dramatic conflict around that issue that we were seeing in the wider society. It was much, it's fair to say, extraordinarily, I'm surprised a majority of farmers seem to want Brexit. I was a Remainer and still am, but we balanced it on the Archers. I can't remember who the Remainers were on the Archers. But if I were saying a good thing about Brexit, it would have been that we freed up our agriculture. Unfortunately, that real Brexit bonus, which would have been getting rid of the Common Agricultural Policy, there's no sign that we've taken it up yet. I just would like to kind of end on a farming note, if I may, Royfield. It's I've always thought this kind of Aldrich style of farming was a disaster. It's a disaster for the planet, and the science is kind of really becoming very clear on this now. You know, we're just what we've done. Really, in the period of the Archers, is take this very sustainable small farms who created landscapes in which was a huge amount of biomass, all the trees and woodlands and the big hedges and all that, which retained a lot of carbon. We've now gone over to a chemical system totally dependent on nitrate fertilizer, which are made from fossil fuel, of course. And that system required us to take out all the hedges, create these great prairies, these great machines. So all that carbon that was in the soil and there's all these hedges now gone into the atmosphere. And the most effective thing we could do to fight climate change is actually to change land use and to put that carbon back into the ground and create more hedges and more wetlands and all that. If we did that, we'd get better food. But we need the kind of landscape that was there when the Archers started. So it's extraordinary. We're at a point now. The Archers, it has a the artist, when it started, actually promoted the government's view that we need big mechanized chemical farms. And now it's clear, if we're going to save our planet, we need small farms, self-sufficient, sustainable, not using nitrate fertilizers, and put carbon back in the ground. And that's the kind of farming we need everywhere in the world, including UK and America. So I think the artist should be leading in that direction.
Well, you know what? I'm going to say that in one regard, the artist is leading, because I wasn't aware of rewilding. I don't claim to be a big environmentalist. Emotionally, I am. I'm always down with the arguments, but I'm much more of a geopolitical animal. And the first time that rewilding was really put in front of me, where I really had to think about it, it was through the Archers. And I understand that it's giving the earth, giving the soil a rest. And through that rest, natural flora and fauna will actually then flourish. Animals which have been in effect kicked off our habitat because we've created this false habitat then come back and recolonize it, you know. So I think the Archers, I completely agree with you, still has a place, and in terms of educating not only farmers but actually the rest of the great British public about the importance of the countryside. So Graham Harvey, thank you for coming on to Dumpty Dum. Please tell us the name of the book, which isn't quite published yet, but how people can get behind it and back it.
Yeah, it's called Underneath the Archers, and it's published by Unbound. So if you go on to unbound.com, you get a chance to pledge support, and hopefully the book will be out next year. It's called Underneath the Archers.
Well, I'm going to make sure that the listeners of Dumpty Dum get behind it. So there you are, good listener. Jump on to your computer right now. Put your phone down, because I know you're listening to the podcast on your phone. Put that down. Jump on your laptop. Get onto the Unbound website. Find Graham's book and pledge some money so we can make sure that it is in all of our Christmas stockings for 2023.
Thank you so much, Roy.
No worries. Listen, what a fascinating conversation. One of the lovely things about interviewing people about the Archers is conversation always slightly goes off on a tangent. And I had no idea that you are the revolutionary that you are, sir. You know, that little did they know when they took you on board back in 1984 that you were going to be a red under the bed. And so for that, brother, I salute you.
The subtitle of my book is Underneath the Archers. It's called My Life as a Secret Agent for Nature.
There you go. Graham, thank you for coming on to Dumpty Dum.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.